You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chitakis. Five Point Valencia is a brand new community next to Six Flags Magic Mountain, like right next to Six Flags. You can see the Tatsu roller coaster track from just about anywhere in the development. It's also quiet, with views of undisturbed nature everywhere you look.
Just away from the hustle and bustle, it's not as busy out here.
Erica and Oscar Miles live in L.A., and they're looking to buy a home out here in the Santa Clarita Valley.
And then you get this beautiful mountain view, and we don't really get that in Los Angeles, so we figured it'd be nice.
The mountain view isn't the only thing that sets this development apart, though. If the Miles family buys a home out here, all the electricity in their home, the energy to heat the community pool they'll use, the power to water the carefully landscaped hillsides, all of that will be net zero. That means this community will cut out or offset all of their greenhouse gas emissions. And it's not the only place to make that commitment. Developers are planning similar housing construction at Tejon Ranch on the L.A. Kern County border. Now, they're currently in a legal battle with several environmental groups, but if it ever gets off the ground, they promise it will be a net zero community as well. We're talking about large ex-urban villages, and urban planners know this sprawl contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. So what does that really mean, a net zero community? How do you even measure that? KCRW's Kaylee Wells went and toured one to find out.
At the Five Point Valencia development, only about 100 people have moved into what will become a village with more than 21,000 homes. You can enter some of them on a self-guided tour. It feels a bit like walking into someone's home. The lights are on, the radio's playing, the kitchen table is set. But there are also little wall placards everywhere, enticing you to look up at the solar panels, check out the smart thermostats, admire this home's energy efficiency score. Everything about this development says new. The young trees are short and supported by splints. The landscaped hills are mostly dirt, dotted with new tiny plants. The roads are dark and smooth, and most of the vehicles on them are helping to finish constructing half-built homes.
Brand new is always good, right? Yes. Who wants to use anything? I mean, we do it because a lot of times we have no choice. I mean, brand new is always better.
That's what enticed Oscar and Erica Miles to take a tour. They're looking at 2,000 square foot townhomes that are in the $700,000 range. The whole net zero thing was more of a bonus.
It's a convenient, cool thing. It wouldn't be a deal breaker, but I mean, I like the fact that it's there.
So how do you make a net zero community? Step one, energy efficient buildings.
Every single home we build is Energy Star qualified, which in fact makes KB Home the number one energy efficient builder in the country.
This is Craig LeMessurier with KB Homes. It's one of the five companies in this development that's building houses.
It's about the construction techniques, the materials, all the things that you wouldn't even think about, you know, insulation, any penetrations in the home, you're caulking and making sure there's no airflow in and out of the home and so forth.
Step two, once the house is as efficient as it can get, then you add the renewable energy sources.
Then you can add solar panels, which will obviously continue to reduce your overall consumption and at the end of the day, save you money.
Which takes us to step three. When the Mileses walk out of their home, they can take their neighborhood electric vehicle, that's basically a golf cart the residents will be encouraged to use in the development, to the geothermally heated pool, passing by drought-tolerant plants irrigated with recycled wastewater and admiring the 10,000 acres of preserved native habitat space in the distance. Any greenhouse gases the development does produce will be offset by doing things like installing solar panels in disadvantaged areas of LA County, capturing methane at a California dairy farm, and replacing wood cookstoves in Africa. And greenhouse gases include resident commutes. That takes us to step four. Erica Miles could work from home some of the time, but Oscar would be pumping extra carbon into the air every day commuting to and from Los Angeles.
It's better to sort of figure out if it's going to work for us, how's the drive up, what's the traffic look like. So we have to sort of see in the afternoon, you know, like look at the map and see what that looks like. And then we'll kind of decide. It is 38 minutes from where we are now.
Okay.
So it's an additional 38 minutes with no traffic.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, that's the problem.
The development is hoping the Miles family will drive an electric car. After all, transportation is the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions in California, and urban sprawl is notorious for making it worse. Every home comes with an EV charger, and the community will have another 2,000 of them in shared spaces. But those are just incentives. What if residents prefer to keep using a gas car? The dreaded super commute is an even bigger sticking point for the more rural Centennial community planned for Tejon Ranch, which is about halfway between Santa Clarita and Bakersfield. Environmental groups have sued to stop it from being built. The court ruled the developers failed to account for the added fire risk that comes with moving thousands of people into a fire-prone area. And there weren't feasible ways to offset the emissions from the thousands of daily car trips the community would add. Developers settled one of those suits by promising the community will be net zero, like Five Point Valencia. But another suit is still active. Still, developers paint a utopian picture of what life in the Tehachapi Mountains could look like in 30 years.
What really is a new town, I think, is the best way to describe it. It's a mixed-use community, so it will consist of 19,300-plus residential units. And that
this is Barry Zoller with Tejon Ranch Company. The price point there will be significantly cheaper than the same home in Los Angeles.
But it also includes 10.1 million square feet of commercial, industrial, and retail space. So it's your schools, it's your parks, it's your research and development facilities.
They're installing a bunch of electric car chargers like Five Point Valencia is. But they're also providing a $5,000 incentive to residents with electric cars. Bryn Lindblad with the environmental nonprofit Climate Resolve, which settled the lawsuit against the Centennial development, says they're guessing that'll convince about half of residents to go electric.
And the remaining 50% that aren't electric, then looking at projects to compensate and mitigate those emissions.
Even if that pans out, the developer estimates the community all told would generate about 500,000 tons of carbon. Half of that would be mitigated in the community with things like solar panels and eliminating gas hookups. The other half would be offset with projects that reduce carbon outside the community. But offsets aren't a very popular option. It's kind of like recycling a beer bottle. It's not a bad practice, but it'd be better not to buy the bottle in the first place.
It's not acceptable for Tejon Ranch to just kind of go buy offsets out on the market of projects that are already happening, say in Africa or Asia. We're trying to get new projects funded to really accelerate and speed up addressing climate change.
Another problem with offsets? Over time, as everyone gets greener, finding places to offset greenhouse gas emissions will get harder. So eventually, this community would just need to figure out how to produce less of them. That's partly why Climate Resolve is overseeing the establishment of a third-party nonprofit organization that would monitor the development's progress. Even with all those variables, Lindblad says she's feeling confident the development would be net zero.
I think we set up a pretty watertight accountability and monitoring system to make sure that, you know, there's not loopholes in the future, that if conditions do change, we have a keen group to make sure that that net zero overall commitment is still being upheld.
If the developers do manage to overcome their legal hurdles, the first residents of Tejon Ranch won't likely move in for another 30 years. By then, it will have been 15 years since the sale of new gas-powered cars was banned in California. By then, with any luck, urban sprawl into rural areas won't just be a contributor to climate change, but a place to experiment with ways to fight it. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. George Gascon has been LA County's district attorney now for close to 14 months. The former LA cop turned San Francisco DA turned LA DA is implementing a criminal justice reform agenda. He has promised to bring accountability to police officers who kill or harm civilians in the line of duty or abuse their power in other ways, and he has vowed to reduce sentences for many offenses. But a couple of recent high-profile cases test the limits of those reforms, or most certainly reveal a backlash against them. Lori Levinson is a professor of criminal law at Loyola Law School and a former assistant U.S. attorney. Hi, Lori.
Oh, hi, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. I'm glad you came on because we wanted to talk to you about this case, the off-duty LAPD officer Fernando Arroyos, who was shot and killed in an attempted robbery last week. Just a terrible story. Only 27 years old, typically a robbery that results in a homicide would be prosecuted by the DA's office, George Gascon. But this investigation, Lori, is being led by the sheriff's department. And Sheriff Alex Villanueva told investigators to bypass Gascon and the DA's office and take this case to the feds. What's going on here?
Well, there are a couple different things going on. One, on the side of the sheriff, there's a lot of politics going on between him and the DA. The sheriff has not been happy about what types of reforms that Gascon wanted to bring in. He doesn't like that there's been a directive that the DA's office not file gang enhancements, not file weapon enhancements, not seek the death penalty. So he's generally not been a big supporter of Gascon. That's a political issue. When it comes down to this tragic case, and as you mentioned, it's an absolutely tragic case, they took it to the federal authorities. And that's a righteous prosecution, in part because the federal authorities have been targeting this particular gang, the Florencia 13, F-13 gang. They've brought racketeering charges against them. And the crime that happened here, the robbery of Fernando Arroyos, wasn't just any robbery. It was of active violence in aid of the racketeering that this gang's done. So that gave the federal authorities jurisdiction and an interest in bringing this case. That serves the interests of the criminal justice system, but it also serves the political interests of the sheriff, because it means that the sheriff had an alternative place to go to and could bypass the DA.
How big a problem, Lori, is the fact that we have this rift between the sheriff versus the DA of the most populous county in the United States? I mean, how big of a rift is this, and how does it affect criminal justice in LA County?
This is not a good thing. Any way you look at it, it's not good for the people of Los Angeles, because you want all of law enforcement working together. You do not want sort of these petty fights going on among them. It is true that the DA is doing things that make people uncomfortable. But don't forget, he's an elected DA too. The biggest problem is that he doesn't necessarily have the support of the people in his office. So you have people attacking him from outside, the sheriff, but you also have people inside the office are not thrilled about these new policies. And meanwhile, people have figured out there are alternative law enforcement groups you can go to and prosecutors. We have the federal U.S. Attorney's Office. We have the city attorney's office. We have the attorney general's office. So if you don't like what Gascon does, sometimes, not always, there are other ways to go.
So could Villanueva going forward do this with other cases as well? You know, he doesn't like the way Gascon is doing his job as a prosecutor in the whole county. So let's just find a different way to do this. We'll go to the feds. We'll, you know, find an alternative way to prosecute these cases.
I actually don't think he'll be able to do it as much as he wants to do it, because the federal authorities don't have a jurisdiction authorization nor an interest in doing the run-of-the-mill cases. You know, the cases, the street violence, it's supposed to go through the DA's office. That's the office that has hundreds of prosecutors. I think it would be really disruptive if all of a sudden you saw the cases that have been, you know, the regular prosecutions for the DA's office, the meat and potatoes, start going to other jurisdictions. The bottom line is that the sheriff saw an opportunity to embarrass Gascon, and he ran this case over to the federal authorities. The federal authorities, on the other hand, I don't think they want anything to do with this tit-for-tat or politics between Gascon and the sheriff. They just saw a righteous case involving this gang that they've been going after for a while and said, this is the case we should file.
Would the sentencing have been different, Lori, if Gascon had gotten the case as opposed to the feds?
I think in this particular case, the federal authorities are set up to get the more significant sentence. I mean, the type of charges they've been bringing, this is called a Vicar, violent crime and aid of racketeering, that carries a life sentence and someone dying, potentially a death penalty case. If you went to the state side, to the DA's office on this case, it wouldn't be a death penalty case. And in fact, it wouldn't have anywhere near the length of gang enhancement that would get you to what would be the minimum sentence here of life without the possibility of parole on the federal charge.
I also want to talk about this case, the Sirhan case, at the state level. Governor Gavin Newsom reversed a decision by the parole board that would have paroled Sirhan. Newsom came out against that. He wrote an op-ed in the LA Times saying, quote, Sirhan has not developed the accountability and insight required to support his safe release into the community. Those are Newsom's words. Sirhan is 77 years old. I mean, if this was any other case, would he be out by now?
Well, if he were any case other than these high visibility cases. So I put it into two groups of defendants who are never getting out. The Manson family members and then Sirhan. Because those cases were just, as you said, sui generis, one of a kind in the history here in California. And in order to sort of say that he wasn't going to let him out, the governor had to find a reason to say that Sirhan is still dangerous. As you pointed out, it's kind of hard to believe at age 77 he is, unless you take a look at how he would influence others to commit violence. But I was not surprised at all by the governor's decision, because that was a case that literally changed history.
The death of Bobby Kennedy, obviously, at the Ambassador Hotel on that fateful night in June of 1968. I mean, would Newsom have allowed Sirhan's parole if the victim wasn't Bobby Kennedy?
I think you can question that, honestly. I think that you can question whether or not they would have allowed parole if it was someone other than the person who killed Bobby Kennedy, who was likely going to be the next president.
Governor Newsom is a supporter of criminal justice reform. I mean, do these two cases potentially undermine the reform efforts of people like Gascon, the district attorney?
I don't think that the governor's decision not to grant parole to Sirhan for killing Bobby Kennedy undermines anything in the criminal justice system other than to say that there are going to be exceptional cases. And this is one of those exceptional cases. Sirhan was convicted of killing Bobby Kennedy. When it comes to other reforms, the governor's been much more enthusiastic, including for parole for people, including for having shorter sentences. So it's hard, however, to sort of just line them up on every issue and say, therefore, the governor is in line with Gascon. No, I think there are probably many areas where they do not agree on things. So it has to be looked at much more closely than that.
Case by case, as it were.
Issue by issue. You know, yeah. We need some reforms here. People agree. We need parole reforms. We need sentencing reforms. We need prison reforms. But it's much more suitable to an individual view rather than say that everything Gascon does is going to improve the criminal justice system.
Because Gascon could have jumped in on the Sirhan case, right? It was in L.A. County at the Ambassador Hotel.
No, but that was one of the reforms that Gascon made. He said that he was no longer going to use his office to oppose paroles. That was something that was traditionally done. It was done under Jackie Lacey. But when Gascon came in, he said, we're not taking that position on parole. So it wasn't a surprise that he didn't do it here.
Lori Levinson, professor of criminal law at Loyola Law School and a former assistant U.S. attorney. Lori, as always, nice to have you on. Thank you.
My pleasure. Talk to you again soon.
Well, from one district attorney to another, this one down in OC. The current Orange County DA, Todd Spitzer, is seeking re-election in June of this year. His term is up. He'll face off against candidate Pete Hardin. That race has been feisty for months, and now Spitzer has launched an attack ad against Hardin titled Predator and IDing it with the hashtag KNOW-LA in OC. Here to give us the lowdown on what's going on in OC and what exactly KNOW-LA in OC means is Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times and, of course, a regular here on GLA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So first off, what are the cornerstones for what each candidate wants to do? Are they running on very different agendas? Is one reform-minded, the other not, or are they both talking tough?
Todd's running on being Todd, which is he's not Tony Rakakis, the former district attorney who went down in a ball of corruption with the OC snitch scandal, which involved jailhouse informants. Todd is running to keep Orange County this magnificent, crime-free place. And Pete Harden, on the other hand, says that Todd Spitzer himself is corrupt because there is actually a lawsuit alleging that a former district attorney, one of Todd Spitzer's lieutenants, was sexually harassing people and that Todd didn't do enough to try to stop it. And Pete Harden does identify with the progressive DA movement that involves George Gascon. They share the same political strategist, Chesa Boden up in San Francisco, all of that. So it is a clash of two diametrically opposing views of the world.
And Spitzer and Harden have been mudslinging, like you say, I mean, diametrically opposed, but they've been mudslinging even before they officially filed to run against one another, right? As in for the district attorney's office.
I mean, the commercial is incredibly laughable. Calls Pete Harden a pervert and a predator. That's from the commercial itself. And Pete Harden, he's just focusing on Todd's record, saying that hate crimes have against Asian American API folks have increased over 1,000% under Todd Spitzer, that he's not doing enough to do criminal justice reform. But when it comes to the mudslinging, Pete's throwing dust, Todd's throwing like a big old mud ball, for lack of a better term.
When I passed this along to you over the weekend because I got a press release from the Spitzer campaign, and in the logo for Spitzer, it has the hashtag KNOW-LA in OC. And I actually circled it in red when I sent it to Gustavo. Anyway, does hating on LA play well to his base? Is that what's going on here?
Oh, of course. That was actually my column over the weekend for the LA Times, where I talked to Todd about it. And I told him he's so proud of it. He coined it. He showed me how smooth it goes on top of his name, Spitzer, at the end. And I told him, Todd, this is juvenile. And he didn't like it. And what he says is that KNOW-LA in OC means that he does not want Orange County to turn into a place where you have all the political controversies that are happening in LA with George Gascon and a lot of the law enforcement establishment against it. But KNOW-LA and OC, according to Todd, that doesn't mean he hates LA. In fact, he loves LA. He taught at Roosevelt High in Boyle Heights. He loves the museums and he loves the culture. He just doesn't want LA and OC.
Well, that's what the hashtag says. Spitzer, Gustavo, took over the DA's office back in 2019, took over from Rakakis. What's his tenure been like? I mean, has he accomplished the goals that he set out for himself?
Of course, he'll say yes. But at the very least, what I try to tell people, and people get mad at me for this, is like Todd is far better than Tony Rakakis. Tony Rakakis was bad, and he had been there for almost 20 years, if not 20 years at that point. So Todd is still Todd, though. And he's an interesting guy. He frustrates me a lot. I've been reporting on him for 20 years, and he's someone who really wants to do good, but he always just steps in it, and he steps on it. No one pushes him towards that, so he's frustrating. He's criticized his own party when they're corrupt or when they do bad things, but then he makes fun of, you know, he makes fun of progressives. He makes fun of Democrats. He's a, you know, he should be a little bit more mature, but he's not corrupt. I'll say that. He's not corrupt.
And he's taking, apparently, Harden's challenge seriously. I mean, is Harden a strong challenger?
He will start fundraising a lot because, again, you do have this movement across the United States. It's not, I'm not making this up, where you're having people wanting to think about how to go after criminal justice reform. And you have these progressives running for prosecutors. It's all, you know, in major urban areas. I don't know. I mean, we'll see with Pete. He's a nice guy. He talks a good talk, but this is Orange County. You still have a lot of that rock rib conservatism still there. And Todd is taking that mantle and running with it. It's the election's going to be in June, so we still have a ways off. But Pete does have an uphill battle against him.
Do you have a sense, Gustavo, that some folks who supported Spitzer in the last election may change and to align with Harden instead, or maybe there's the taint, right, of the snitch scandal from many years ago? Or did Todd Spitzer, you know, just pretty much clear the slate?
A lot of people in Orange County do not like Todd Spitzer because Todd is Todd. Just over, you know, always looking for a camera, always just being way too effusive and like running. He kind of like, McGruff, the crime dog, running all around for all that. And so he has turned off a lot of people over the years, but they're not going to sign up for someone like Pete Hardin who says, hey, we need to do like this progressive enforcement. So that's what Pete's challenge is going to be. It's like, okay, people who are disenchanted with Todd just trying too hard, can we get him off? Can we get them on our side, especially at a time where crime is also increasing in Orange County as well? I mean, that's the one thing that Todd cannot defend. It's like crime has increased. It's not as much as he wants to talk trash on LA. Well, Orange County is also experiencing a crime wave. So Todd has to answer for that.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times. Of course, one of our regulars here at GLA. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, a show that focuses on the push among Democrats in the California legislature to establish a single-payer healthcare system. Is it doable? How much would it cost? Who's against the idea and why? Tomorrow on a new episode of GLA. And, of course, online for your perusal or get the podcast wherever you get them. Jenna Cagle, welcome back, Jenna. Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, John Meek, Greg Warner, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your time and for your ears tonight. Have a great night.